Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For the last year, the whole world has watched as American forces invaded Iraq, tossed out a regime, and occupied the country. Many nations and groups beyond nations have a powerful interest in the outcome, but ultimately, and every hour and every day, it is the people of Iraq who are living with the direct consequences, good and bad, of the war. We have heard this week from scholars, politicians, and soldiers. Tonight we hear from Iraqis themselves, the people who have lived with tyranny, bombing, terrorism, and glimmers of hope. This hour, On Point, a roundtable conversation with Iraqis on the war, reconstruction, and life in Iraq 1 year on. Joining me tonight from Baghdad is Hassan Fatah, editor of Iraq Today, an English-language weekly newspaper based in Baghdad. Good evening and welcome, Hassan Fatah.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for being with us. Also joining me is Dr. Raja Huzai, a member of the Iraqi Governing Council. She is an OBGYN, a professor of medicine, and founder of the Women's Health Center in Baghdad. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Raja Huzai.
Good evening.
Thank you so much for being with us. There's so much we want to learn from you tonight. Raja Huzai, if I may just turn to you first at a very personal level and ask, if it's not too personal, how is your family?
Very well. They're very well, and they're proud of my work, you know. I have 7 children. I have 4 girls and 3 boys, and they're wonderful, and they're very happy.
And how are they living, how are they flourishing, or otherwise, in the circumstances of war's aftermath, Dr. Huzai?
3 of the daughters are married. The eldest, she's a medical doctor, she's a radiologist, and she's working in Halle. Her husband is a surgeon. The second one is a biologist. She's not working yet. She has got 2 daughters. The third, Rana, she is an economist, and she has a little boy, 1 year old. And the fourth is Haidar. He's my eldest son. He will be qualified from College of Medicine in June. The fifth, Dalia, she's a daughter. She's in 4th year College of Pharmacy in Baghdad. And Mustafa, he's in 6th year secondary school. He will be in university next year. And Abdullah, he's in 4th year secondary school. All well.
It's a fantastic lineup.
Thank you. The boys are living in Diwaniya with my husband. As you know, he's a surgeon.
Yes.
And Dalia, she's living with me. And the other 2 living in Baghdad. They are married.
So you have family in Baghdad, in Diwaniya, in the south of the country. And is it possible, with 7 children, and you obviously are in a high-ranking position in Iraq, serving on the Iraqi Governing Council, even in that position, is it possible now, 1 year after the invasion, to live what you would call a normal life, Dr. Huzai?
Oh, yes. It's a very normal life. They're all happy, and the doctor is working, and Haider is going to qualify in June. He's studying hard, and other boys are studying hard, especially Mustafa, because he's going to university. Dalia, she's going to College of Pharmacy daily, and she's so happy because she's living with me, you know, all the time. She misses me when I travel. Otherwise, she's proud of me.
Hassan Fatah, we have here what sounds like a picture of domestic bliss and tranquility and enterprise. How representative is Raja Huzai's family of what typical Iraqi families are experiencing right now?
Indeed, it's certainly an honor to be on the line here with Dr. Raja, who I have great respect for and is truly one of the trailblazers of the new Iraq. She is truly the face of the new Iraq. I have to say, you know, what can you say? You have to live your life. You have to live life within it all. And I think what's interesting about Iraq today is that people are basically trying to live around all the conditions that they face. I'm sure that Dr. Rajat's family has gone through all the sort of through the pain and the agonies of over the past decades of the former regime. And I think that the daily life here in Baghdad entails a lot of new considerations that most people may never have considered before. Considerations of their basic safety, being out at night, general things. I mean, I'll give you an example of Baghdad specifically. Baghdad used to be all about nightlife. It was a city that people loved to come to because the nightlife here was fabulous. By about 10 o'clock now, there's nobody on the streets, really. People tend to come home for safety, for security, and tend to stay with family much more so than before. Public life, I think, has been very, very much impinged by conditions. The hope is that this is sort of the time in between. This is the transitional period. The hope is that, you know, when a government, an Iraqi government that speaks the language of Iraqis and speaks for Iraqis takes over, a lot of these sorts of issues will be better dealt with.
Hassan Fateh, for some years before the invasion, while Saddam Hussein was in power, you lived outside the country. In fact, you're an American citizen. You've come back. What's your sense of the psychological health of the country after all the trauma of years of tyranny and then the trauma of war?
Well, I think this is a country that's been waiting to grieve and actually has yet to be able to begin grieving. And I think that's one of the hardest parts here. It's a country that sort of collectively needs to come together and be able to sigh, to think about the things that have happened over the past two decades, three decades, to kind of remember fallen brothers and cousins and relatives. I mean, almost everybody you meet here has a cousin who was killed in the Iran-Iraq War or in the Gulf War, had a relative who was thrown in jail or was tortured in jail. Almost everyone you meet here has gone through all manner of misery and tragedy that I don't think any American could comprehend. The problem is that the grieving process for all that has really yet to begin. Perhaps it's just beginning now, but the sooner it begins, the sooner we get to stability and a sense of a new nation.
Dr. Hajjal, you see women in your practice in Baghdad and in Diwaniya. You deal with their physical ailments, but you must also have a sense of their mental health. How would you describe the profile of Iraqi women that you're seeing? How are the scars of the past affecting them today? What's their outlook looking forward?
In Saddam's time, the women suffered a lot because of the loss of the husband and the brothers and the sons and so on. They lived in misery for the last 25 years or more. In my profession, I'm dealing with women all the time. And because I'm in my hometown working, the women, they don't only complain for me their health problem, but they tell me stories of their lives. I know they suffered a lot. They have no money. There are 7% of the women in Diwaniya are young widows who their husbands died during the wars or been executed by the regime. Whenever I talk to a woman, the tears came down. I'm sure most of them has suffered mentally as well as financially and socially. That's why I have founded Iraqi Widows Organization. I started it in Diwaniya, and I asked one of my colleague, he's a psychiatrist, and I asked him if he can see these ladies with their mental health free of charge, and he accepted. Really, he was elated because I asked him to assess my widows. Their ages between 20 and 40. I have one widow, she's 16 years old. Most of them, they have children and they have no support. Really, what I want financial support. I want the people or the women in the world to help these widows because they need help. Now they are much better. At least they feel that they can get rid of the nightmare. They are optimistic, and they come every time I ring them to come for a meeting, and they tell me all their stories.
Dr. Hajjal, if I may ask you, on this anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion, a lot of Americans are thinking deeply about whether the United States has done the right thing in Iraq and what its obligations are going forward, what it needs to do going forward. You're on the Iraqi Governing Council. In a way, that's a kind of stamp of approval by American authorities at some level, I guess. But when you talk to your patients, what do they think about what the United States has done and what it now needs to do in Iraq?
All the women in Iraq are very grateful to the United States and to Mr. Bush because he took the lead in liberating us. Nobody can assess how very important freedom is unless you feel that you are not free. Now they are happy and they look forward to be trained so that they can support themselves. They want to go back to school. We have 50% of the girls dropped out of school. They want to go back to school. The illiteracy now has risen to 70% in the women. And I want really to help them in making classes for them. And it's so difficult for me because I don't want to be late for the women in Iraq. They suffered a lot. And they can't wait anymore.
So you feel a kind of urgency there. Hassan Fateh, how widespread is this attitude? Dr. Hazzah is on the Governing Council, but she expresses gratitude to the United States, gratitude to President Bush. We saw this week a poll that came out of the UK, sponsored by a number of media organizations, that found 42% of Iraqis saying the war liberated Iraq, and only 33% of Arab Iraqis saying that. At the same time, 48% of Arab Iraqis saying it humiliated the country. How representative is Dr. Hazzah's view?
Well, I think, look, anything is better than Saddam Hussein. Let's face that. And I think we have to be careful of not getting stuck on that. In effect, what the U.S. did by invading Iraq and occupying Iraq is provide a promise that life is going to get better. Life is going to get much better. Things are going to change dramatically. The fundamental reality is, in fact, yes, with Saddam gone, life is better. There is now opportunity. There is a chance for people to change their lives. A lot of my reporters remind me that, today there's a way you can plan ahead. You can start to begin to think about a future. You can begin to think about what could come forward. The sad thing is that all of that goodwill, all of that happiness, all of that, in fact, gratitude, has been very much overshadowed by a lot of policy decisions. Policy decisions that didn't necessarily need to be made, for which we now are actually paying a heavy price.
Such as?
Fundamentally, issues such as dissolving the Iraqi army, overnight creating 500,000 people who are effectively enemies or at least grumbling at U.S. actions, people who see themselves as having in effect allowed the U.S. to come in and occupy the Iraq, and by standing down and not fighting as hard as they could have. And numerous other decisions. Just as importantly, I think, in many ways, there were a lot of policy decisions about control and allowing Iraqis to sort of run their lives that took a long time to come together. I think, especially in the early days of this occupation, the U.S. tried to do too much controlling, too much of driving the bus, rather than teaching the driver how to drive better.
Dr. Hazzah, do you share that view, and do you feel Americans now handing over the reins to Iraqis? Are you confident of that?
I'm confident that the 30th of June authority will be handed over to the Iraqis. And about the army, 500,000 of the Iraqi army has been dismissed, what they call it, released. And everyone has got a family of at least five, if not as big as my family. So it will be 2,500,000. They are out of job. They have no support. I think it was a mistake. This is my opinion. And they shouldn't have done this. They should have used them for the security of Iraq, except the heads, the big heads, the Ba'athis, they can dismiss them.
There's a lot more that we want to hear, and we'll be joined by more Iraqis from Iraq and beyond this evening. I've been talking with Hassan Fatah, editor of Iraq Today in Baghdad, and in Baghdad, Dr. Raja Huzai, a member of the Iraqi Governing Council and OBGYN. We are talking tonight with Iraqis about Iraq 1 year after invasion. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight with Iraqis about Iraq 1 year after invasion. I'm joined tonight from Baghdad by Dr. Raja Huzai. She is founder of the Women's Health Center in Baghdad and a member of the Iraqi Governing Council. Also from Baghdad, Hassan Fatah, editor of Iraq Today, an English-language weekly newspaper based in Baghdad. We're joined now from Anan, Jordan, by Adil Kanani. He is a 40-year-old Iraqi engineer. He lives in Jordan and owns a contracting company in Baghdad, spends his time going back and forth between the two. Good evening and welcome, Adil Kanani.
Hello, sir.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us tonight from Jordan. But I understand you're often in Iraq. The contracting business must be good these days with all the rebuilding going on.
That's absolutely right. There's a booming of work going on in Iraq for the infrastructure, especially electricity and water business. And we are in the water business for more than 10 years now. And we see that everybody, the CPA and every NGO is interested in establishing a new infrastructure in Iraq, and it's a very good opportunity for any contracting company to be now in Iraq, for sure.
So at this point, are you optimistic about the future, or are the infrastructure requirements overwhelming, Adil Kanani?
Well, we are all really waiting for these promises that we always hear for the stages of rebuilding Iraq. Finally, I knew that in April, major contracts will be on ground on Iraq, and Iraqi local companies will have the opportunity to work together with foreign companies to carry on these contracts.
Have you already been working in contracts with the CPA or not yet?
Yes, we have, but you know, prime contracts take the big jobs for sure, and step by step, these contracts go to smaller and smaller contractors, to reaching local contractors, Iraqi companies, and this is a waste of time, efforts, and money. You know.
So you're saying bring the prime contracts to Iraqis, Adil Kanani. We don't have so much time tonight. Look into the future for us. If you look 5 years out, 10 years out, what kind of future do you see for Iraq?
Well, as Iraqis, we compare our country with the neighboring country around Iraq. We hope that we can establish a system in Iraq that is similar, at least similar, to the countries around Iraq. So we have communication, banking system, security, peace, no wars, and a bright future for our children. I think that can be achieved with CPA intention.
That is the coalition, the American ally there. And yet I understand, Adil Kanani, that you are planning to move your family to Canada in a couple of weeks. Why?
That's right. That's right. You know, I applied for Canadian visa 5 years ago during the Saddam regime, where we were not secured, even when I have all the elements of successful business, we were not secure. So all Iraqis need to make another option for a secure life, and I was one of them. Last year, when the damaging is gone and Iraq was liberated, I was really thinking of canceling this idea of going to Canada, since we are liberated and there is no more fear. But now, 1 year later, I really think that it was good having this other choice of going to Canada, since security is still not achieved for my family, at least.
Security is still a real issue in Baghdad. Hassan Fatah, I want to ask you, if I may, about the U.S. troops in Iraq as we speak tonight. I guess there are about 115,000 there. There have been more. There's a big rotation going on now.
There's a huge rotation going on.
What's your experience, what's your observation of how these troops are interacting with the Iraqi people? What's the attitude of Iraqis toward them? Are they happy to see them? Are they angry? There's clearly a mix, but how would you describe?
Well, just to be fair, I mean, there's a whole batch of new young people that are coming through. These are people who no doubt are scared, are very concerned. They also don't quite know the place as compared to the previous platoons and regiments that were here. In the past several days, I've seen things that are quite dangerous, and a lot of confrontations that have occurred that are very unfortunate and underscore number one, the fear of the soldiers and the sort of disconnect.
Can you give us an example to help us understand what you're describing there?
Well, just yesterday, a camera crew from the Arab satellite channel Al Arabiya was shot in a very unfortunate incident. I would call it an accident more than anything else. I don't think anybody intended to do this. But I think new young people that are coming through are so scared that they're more likely to pull the trigger than ask questions afterwards. It is sort of a problem. That said, I think on the whole, Iraqis are sort of trying to live around the soldiers. I think nobody's ever going to be happy with a foreign soldier speaking a completely different language, not really communicating with you, and holding a weapon and telling you what to do. It's never going to, no matter what you do, occupations are bad things. Occupations are difficult things. Occupations should be avoided at all costs, really, if you can. And I think that a lot of the reactions you get are come from that. It's a very hard thing to swallow to see an American soldier on your territory in the first place, but it's just as dangerous and troublesome that a lot of the soldiers are simply unable to communicate with the Iraqis themselves. English is not so common in Iraq, at least not as common as it used to be. And I think that's a major issue. But no matter what you do, you're never going to get around the fact that, you know, nobody's going to be comfortable and happy to have foreign soldiers on their soil.
Ariel Khanani, we see again in the poll that was taken earlier this week, only about 15% of Iraqis wanting U.S. troops to go. Yet, as we called to Iraq in the last couple of days, setting up these conversations, we had people refuse to talk to us. In fact, just today, a woman in Baghdad refusing, saying there's no use in talking about the situation in Iraq anymore. She was friends with the two Al Arabiya journalists who were killed by American soldiers. She said she doesn't feel safe, that her husband had gone to be with the families of those new dead. She was alone with her children. She was in her house in the night and shivering with fear. She doesn't want to leave Iraq, she said, but she feels as if she has to. What's your sense of the American troops there? Are they necessary there? Should they stay? Should they go?
Well, I think it's necessary for them to be there, but I think they have to deal with Iraqi people, and then I don't know, maybe in a different way, that they have to make them feel comfortable. This woman you're talking about, I think you cannot blame. She hear there's no electricity, dark everywhere, and children are afraid. They hear bombs, they hear fights, they hear accidents are everywhere, so you can't blame them of these incidents, you know.
And Dr. Haza, your sense of the American military presence and how long it should go on?
Well, it could well be for 18 months more. We need their presence, as the poll showed, because the Iraqi army hasn't been completed yet, neither the Iraqi police or the civilian army. The problem is that the American soldiers, they haven't studied the Iraqi culture properly. They behave as if they are afraid from the Iraqis. They pull trigger quickly. While the Iraqis, they welcome them when they first enter Iraq, and they show them the way, and they told them a lot of nice stories, and they are very happy and welcoming them. Still, they need to be friendly. And about the electricity, Adil said, the electricity, honestly, is not as bad as in Saddam time. I live in Diwaniya all the time since 1977, and since 91 till the liberation, the power, they gave us the power only 2 hours per day, and we had to buy a generator and other, depend on the state of the economy of the family. Some of the family use gas lighters and things, But in Baghdad and in Tikrit, they feel that it is bad, the electricity, because they had it 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
Now the distribution of electricity is equal, and we are having it, say, 2 hours on and 2 hours off, or 4 hours on and 2 hours off, which is excellent, and it is progressing week by week.
Mm.
And I hope before June we will have it 24 hours a day all over Iraq.
But for now, those areas that had privileged supplies before feel shortchanged, while others may feel better.
That's it, yeah. But the other areas, they feel, you know, happy because they have it, you know, immediately 12 hours a day. You can't judge unless you live in Iraq and you know what happened.
Hassan Fateh, if I may, you mentioned, everyone did, the fear of American soldiers. When we look at the death toll that continues to mount there, and of course thousands of Iraqis have died, but those soldiers will pay attention to the deaths in their ranks, 570 and more now since the invasion began. And of course, much of that from roadside bombings, from car bombs, again, that have killed many Iraqis as well. What is your sense of the source of this violence in Iraq today?
Well, what is the source? I mean, in the end, there's a resistance, and there's a group of people that essentially want the Americans out at all costs. Of course, the problem with it is that there is so many different resistances. In fact, there isn't just one resistance. In fact, if you want to categorize it, there's four different groups of people trying to really accomplish four different things. And that's what makes it difficult. You've got, say, tribal people who are effectively wanting revenge for things done on to tribal members, family members, that sort of thing. Those are the guys who are in the basement, in the living room, who basically take up arms and want to go and just hit an American.
Mm-hmm.
You've got former regime figures who, for all manner of reasons, essentially want to come back to power or gain some power. It's not necessarily about bringing back Saddam now, but it is about themselves becoming more powerful. Just as important, you have religious figures, people who essentially want to create simply trouble and ensure that this occupation or this reconstruction doesn't work. And then finally, you've got, of course, the foreign fighters and a lot of foreigners and foreign forces that want to ensure that this doesn't work. It's a really difficult combination of groups of people because you can deal with one, but you're not necessarily dealing with the other. And that's what makes it so difficult.
Adil Kanani, you're there in Amman, Jordan. What's your sense of the foreign factor in the terrorism we're seeing in Iraq these days? How significant among these many parties that Hassan Fateh has pointed out?
Well, everybody is concerned in Iraq, my friends, my family. Everybody I know, that these incidents in Iraq, especially the suicide bombing, is not related to Iraqi community at all. And one of the main reasons that I can feel myself when I come to Iraq is the borders. They are absolutely open to anyone without checking any passports or identity. Anyone can now get into Iraq without custom check, without identity check, and do whatever he likes for special benefits or political benefits.
The top U.S. generals in Iraq have said just today that they cannot train and equip Iraqi security forces fast enough to stop the mounting toll of civilian deaths there. And they've suggested that Iraq is simply going to have to deal with a certain amount of this kind of terrorist violence, perhaps for a long time to come. Adil Kanani, what do you think the impact of ongoing violence like this might be for Iraq?
Well, if this violence continues, absolutely it will reflect the stability of the community. Many people that I know personally are really thinking of ending their business in Iraq and establish another business in Jordan and Syria and other countries. And this is not what we are looking for our country, for sure.
So, Dr. Raja Hazal, what's the answer here? The United States is pointing to democracy as the solution, ultimately. Do you see that as the way for Iraq to get past the violence that it's currently facing, or will it need something else?
Well, probably you may not know that during the War of Liberation, these foreign fighters were welcomed by Saddam. They were, as we heard at that time, about 6,000 of them, and they've been prepaid, you know, while they were at home, and they came over, and they joined the Fida'iyu Saddam army. I have a colleague of mine, he's an anesthetist, He told me when we were during the war in last March that he gave anesthesia to an injured man. He was fighting with Fidayi Saddam, and he was Syrian. This is the fact that we have such a huge number already inside Iraq during the war. Now they start to do their operations with the help of the Ba'athis people who had lost their job. They were happy with the regime because they've been given salaries and palaces. And
they were given those salaries before, but what's the solution now, Dr. Hazar?
Well, the solution, I think, is to control the border first, and then they will get fed up and they will go home because they want to create fighting in between the Iraqis, like the Shi'i and Sunni, or Kurds and Arab and Turkoman. But they can't because Iraq is one nation, and we will never allow them to do such things. They will be tired and fed up, and they will go home. Do you know, I visited the injured people in Karbala and Kavmiya.
Yeah.
I visited two hospitals, one in Yarmouk, which is in Baghdad, and the other one, Kavmiya Hospital. And I saw the women and children and men being burned and injured, and 90% of them had operations for crush injuries. But you see the morale on their faces, and they talk, you know, as if they were heroes. And people from Fallujah and Ramadi, they came over to Karbala and Kavmiya to donate blood for them. These terrorists, they cannot make the division in the Iraqis. Iraq is one nation, and we've been living like this for the last hundreds of years, and they will never reach their goal.
Hassan Fatah, how do you see democracy, if and as it comes, interacting with these tensions, with this violence? Does it help, or does it make things more volatile?
One of the bigger issues here is that this is a war of perceptions as much as it is a war of bullets. One of the things that needed to be happening here was to give Iraqis a stake, the average Iraqi, the confidence that this process is going to work out, number one, that he's included and that democracy is going to work in his favor. One of the unfortunate things that has happened is that far too often the average Iraqi feels left out, doesn't feel they have a voice, and on top of it is facing all this violence all around them that even under Saddam's time he didn't necessarily feel if he didn't cross certain red lines. And I think that's what makes it so difficult. Democracy is obviously and certainly the only way, but it's going to take a long time to bring everybody on board. And that is mainly because I think, unfortunately, because of a lot of the decisions that were made earlier on that we mentioned before and countless other decisions that were made. I think, you know, one of the unfortunate things, for example, is that the governing council is actually close to the average Iraqi. We don't know what's going in there, and that is a nascent example of democracy occurring. It's only unfortunate, in fact, because I think any Iraqi who's able to, say, tune in on TV and watch a governing council session would probably see a lot of the governing council members representing him. But because they don't see it, because they don't hear it, because they don't feel it, they don't necessarily think the governing council represents them. That's just one example of the kind of sense of being shut out from a lot of this reconstruction, rebuilding effort.
Hassan Fatah, Raja Khazai, Adil Kanani, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back. We are talking tonight on the one-year anniversary of the invasion of Iraq with Iraqis about Iraq. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight with Iraqis about Iraq 1 year after invasion. I'm joined tonight from Amman, Jordan, by Adil Kanani. He's a 40-year-old Iraqi engineer. He lives in Amman for 2 weeks, and then Baghdad for 2 weeks. He's in the contracting business, and business is good. Joining us from Baghdad is Dr. Raja Hazai. She is a founder of the Women's Health Center in Baghdad and a member of the Iraqi Governing Council. Also with us from Baghdad tonight, Hassan Fatah, editor of Iraq Today, an English-language weekly newspaper based in Baghdad. Adil Kanani, let me turn to you on the subject of the future of democracy in Iraq. Hassan Fatah has just been saying that ordinary Iraqis need to feel a stake in the government. They need to see the kind of deliberation that's going on. There is much talk and many plans for that to happen. What is your level of optimism that the government there will be able to effectively implement democratic procedures that will lead to stability in Iraq?
Well, I think Iraq is a special case for democracy because we have so many parties and religions, ethnic religions in Iraq, and just giving democracy 100% just like that, pushing a button, it's very difficult for everybody to deal with, and that's why we are seeing this so much conflict between all parties. I think this process will need much more time for everybody to realize the feeling of democracy and to respect each other's opinions.
In the meantime, as the United States, the coalition, hands over authority to Iraqis in June and makes plans for more political development there, Paul Bremer presumably steps out of his quite so strong lead position. Adil Kanani, do you think that Iraq needs a new strong leader? Where might that person emerge from? Would that get in the way of democracy?
Well, Iraq is used to having a strong leadership all through the history of Iraq. But, you know, we thought after the liberation of Iraq, we got rid of this habit and we'll have a democracy at last. But reality in this 1 year shows that a strong rule is needed, at least in this stage. This strong rule can be combined by the coalition forces and Iraqi forces, of course, in a way that can set a reliable system in Iraq that can respect and reinforce law and regulation.
Raja Hazai, you're on the Iraqi Governing Council. As the United States pulls back from such heavy involvement in the daily affairs of Iraq, do you think democracy will fill the void, or do you think some strong leader may emerge, democratic or not, to fill that void?
Well, I think democracy will succeed in Iraq slowly. We don't want a strong leadership because we'll have another dictator. The Iraqi people, they are clever, and they suffered a lot. They can choose their leader, and they have the right, and this is democracy. Now, most of the Iraqis, they don't know what democracy means. They don't know what election means, and they don't know what voting means. On these issues, we have started, for me, myself, through the National Council of Women. I'm going to start next week to do training sessions for the women, train them what democracy means, what election means, how you vote, and all these sort of things that helps the women. And I'm sure the men will do such things. But I felt that if I train a woman, I'll train a family. And this issue, we can reach June with the most of the women has been trained already. Democracy is the best solution for the Iraqis. They have suffered 35 years of dictatorship. They can't stand anymore. All the brains, they went outside Iraq. We want these brains to come back, women and men, to share in the rebuilding of the new Iraq. And we'll see the future will be bright, inshallah.
Hassan Fateh, we only have a couple of minutes left. Let me ask you, going forward, the United States remains an enormous presence in Iraq, and all indications are maybe for some time. How do you read the fundamental motivations of the United States in its involvement in Iraq?
You know, it's a very hard thing to do, to be honest with you. In many ways, Iraq today is the front lines for so many different battles, battles over ideas, whether it is a redefinition of the entire Arab region, whether it is the battle between, say, the new Europe and the old Europe, whether it is the battle between the UN and the US, all these different battles are all playing out here today. All these different concepts about world leadership, about government, about politics, about world order are playing out here, ironically. It is such an important battlefront as a result, and it is such an important place, strategically speaking, in terms of the region and in terms of the future of politics and around the world, in essence.
But do you think the United States has brought the motivation and goals to Iraq that are best aligned to support Iraq on a path towards success, whatever that may be?
I'm an Iraqi American, so I understand America and understand American politics, and I was involved in American politics in the U.S. for a long time. I have to admit to you that many times I find myself at a loss to understand why certain things are being done, why certain decisions have been made. I do believe that ultimately Iraq will win out of this, Iraq has to win out of this. And I think that America can only win when Iraq wins. And the answer to it then becomes that it's about the policies and the decisions that America makes over the next several months, over the next several years that that result in this. One of the bigger dangers is essentially leaving it to how Afghanistan is today, which is sort of limping along, not really done, as sort of an unfinished project. That's the biggest fear that I have about the future of this country. Just as importantly, I have a fear that all the power vacuums will actually pull this country into a civil war. I think Iraqis themselves are very well aware of this. And I think that Iraqis are aware of an attempt by all kinds of foreign powers to try to drive this country into civil war and are resisting it. I just hope that they can continue to resist it and that, in fact, the goodwill of all these people continues to be delivered.
Well, it's been fascinating talking with all of you tonight. Adil Kanani, a final question for you. You're moving with your family to Canada. You have three children. Do you dream that one day they might return to Iraq and make that again their home?
Absolutely sure. I am positive of that.
Well, we wish you luck with that, and we thank you, each and every one, for being with us tonight. Dr. Raja Hazai in Baghdad, founder of the Women's Health Center and a member of the Iraqi Governing Council, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Hassan Fatah, editor of Iraq Today in Baghdad, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And Adil Kanani, good luck to you and your family, and thanks for joining us tonight from Amman, Jordan. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
1 year ago, military forces of a strong coalition enforced United Nations demands to defend our security and to liberate that country from the rule of a tyrant.
We're still bogged down in Iraq, and the administration stubbornly holds to failed unilateral policies that drive potential, significant, important, long-standing allies away from us.
The hotel where apparently a number of foreigners were staying has been completely gutted and destroyed. Its facade is crumbling. Pieces of the building are still falling off.
Naturally, one may protest the reasons for the war action in Iraq. I personally think that today, Iraq without Saddam Hussein is truly a better Iraq than with Saddam Hussein. But naturally, I also feel uncomfortable due to the fact that we were misled with the information on weapons of mass destruction.
Aquí ha habido una ruptura de la política.
He's very firm on this. He went on radio here just a couple of hours ago and said the occupation of Iraq is a fiasco. There have been almost more deaths after the war than before the war. So, yeah, he's definitely going to bring the troops home.
Here is a country who stood against terrorism and had a huge terrorist act within their country, and they chose to change their government and to, in a sense, appease terrorism.
The resistance that is being offered by the people there, we feel that they may be a high-value target.
About 1:45 p.m., when President Chen and the Vice President Anadu, they make a big rally in Tainan City, and they were shot.
Investigation conducted has identified McCoy as a suspect in these I-270 cases.
Both sides have been beaten up on the other in the most negative campaign earlier than I've ever seen. I'd like to see it stop. I'd like to see a serious discussion about Medicare, Social Security, education, what we're going to do about the deficit and overspending.
And there's a week. President Bush marks the one-year anniversary of the war in Iraq, calling the U.S.-led invasion that country's day of deliverance. His Democratic rival John Kerry criticizes progress in Iraq, saying the U.S. is bogged down there. A powerful blast destroys a Baghdad hotel. The president of Poland says he was misled into joining the coalition against Iraq. Spain's newly elected prime minister, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, says he is prepared to withdraw Spanish troops from Iraq in the wake of last week's bombing in Madrid. That prompted some, like House Speaker Dennis Hastert, to accuse Spaniards of appeasing terrorists. Pakistani authorities believe they have al-Qaeda's number two man, Ayman al-Zawahiri, surrounded near the Afghan border. Taiwan's president survives being shot on the eve of an election there. Police arrest accused Ohio sniper Charles McCoy in Las Vegas. And Senator John McCain scolds the Bush administration for portraying John Kerry as weak on defense and calls on both parties to stop their negative campaigning. Jack Beatty, much going on many fronts.
Yes, in an exchange this week on the political front between Vice President Cheney and John Kerry, the Vice President made a stinging, sarcastic, in its way, entertaining speech where he just lashed at Kerry as somebody who was weak on defense. He even set up a sort of antithesis between here's what a senator does. He takes these positions. A president decides, very much going at that note, which I think we're going to hear a lot of, and in general coming at Kerry very hard. Of course, as others have pointed out, some of the weapon systems he criticized Kerry for being against in the early 90s, Secretary of Defense Cheney, then Secretary of Defense Cheney, had been against. But that's the fine print. But while Cheney was delivering his speech on the split screen, we saw the blowing up of the hotel in Baghdad. Of course, he was also saying that the war was, our troops were making progress there. So that little paradigm shows how news is going to continue to break into, almost literally, the speeches and certainly the policies and the politics of the administration this year.
Fascinating once again to see John McCain show up in the middle of this, and this time sort of pulling these two wrestlers apart and saying, settle down here, boys, and defending the Democrat, John Kerry.
Yeah, who's a very good friend of his, he said, and he said he disagrees with Kerry on a lot of things and that he has forgotten about the Carolina, South Carolina campaign where President Bush's team pretty much roughed him over in the 2000 primaries. But it's always been clear that he has no love lost between McCain and Bush. And he said, yeah, he's not weak on defense, and that's good. But I also think he spoke out of John McCain is a real sort of weather vane of the independent voter in America. I think when he ran for president, that was clear that there was almost some talk of a new party forming of, you know, people tired of the partisanship on both sides and meeting in the middle. And I think that must reflect what he's hearing from that voter, from those voters, about the negative ads on both sides so early. And he made a good point. He says this is going to drive down turnout. And of course, one of the theses about negative ads is just that it drives away independents. They don't vote. It becomes then a base election in all senses of the word.
Yeah. Jack, as you say, news on all fronts may be driving the elections this year. An interesting flash out of Iran.
Yes, there was. This was a scoop in the Financial Times that since May of last year, the administration has had the possibilities, the makings of what the Times called a grand bargain with Iran. Iran would stand down on terrorism, stand down on whatever it's doing on nuclear matters, agree to a two-state solution with Israel-Palestine. In return, we would resume trade with it, recognize it, and so on. This deal has been there, but not accepted because Vice President Cheney wants to keep confronting Iran. I think we're going to hear more about this. If there is a deal there on the table and the administration is spurning it out of just hardline reasons, we should hear more about this in coming weeks.
Depending how Iraq unfolds, they may very much want Iran's support before too long there.
Yes, when you think of it that way, absolutely.
Jack, thanks for being with us tonight, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Jane Manners. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.